with habitats that range from wetlands to prairies to forests to savannas. It's no wonder that here in Wisconsin we enjoy such a rich diversity of wildlife. And I think it's really part of our culture to notice and appreciate what's going on around us in different seasons. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're really fortunate to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven come by once a month to share what he's been seeing and to help us understand what's going on out there. Today, Scott joins us from the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation in Dundee, Illinois. Great to have you with us as always, Scott.
Well, it's great to be here. It's great to be here at the McGraw Wildlife Foundation as well.
Well, and tell us about McGraw. What goes on there?
Well, it's an amazing place. We're only 15-20 minutes from O'Hare International Airport, but it's an 1,800-acre oasis of ponds and streams and woodlands and managed fields and so forth. It's a private foundation devoted to education, some wildlife research, and it's also a private shooting preserve. So there's pheasant hunting here and fishing for the membership and so forth, and a very nice amenities and facilities. So it's a great place to conduct the program that quite a few of us have gathered here from around the country to offer another week-long session of what we call our Conservation Leaders for Tomorrow program. So we have 15, I'll call them students, but they're actually agency employees from fish and wildlife agencies from Florida to Arizona to Vermont, New Jersey, Illinois, basically all over the country. They're here for a week to work with us on awareness issues on consumptive wildlife use, hunting, trapping, and fishing, and it's designed for agency employees who have no prior exposure to those activities. Our sense is that people involved in resource management it's not a recruitment program by any means. We're not trying to create or recruit hunters, for example, but we do feel strongly that people in the position of managing our natural resources should at least understand the motivations and passion and techniques and so forth of hunters and anglers.
So you're actually working there. I'm sure you're fitting in some time to do some fun stuff, but you're actually they're putting you to work.
Yes, we have sadly in some ways we have very long days, but it's a great group of students, and most of the instructors are old friends, so even when we're working, we're having a good time.
That's great. Well, I want to let our listeners know how they can join in. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question, comment, or photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Scott can't actually see Facebook right now, but maybe we can get him to take a look later and comment on some things. And of course, often we find that the fellow listeners looking at it jump in with information for people before we can even get to it. So feel free to get in touch any of those three ways. Well, Scott, you just talked about the passion for hunting and fishing. Let's talk a little bit about sturgeon season. It opens this Saturday. Tell us about sturgeon, first of all, and where the best place to fish for them are.
Well, the season does open this Saturday, I believe, at 6 a.m. From what I read about the prospects, people are expecting a very good year. This is a spearing season, by
mm-hmm.
the way.
Right.
This is the famous, hey, gather in the shanty on Lake Winnebago and basically that whole river system and sit there staring down an oblong hole in the ice waiting for a giant prehistoric-looking fish to pass by and then hopefully spear it and get it out on the ice and register it and enjoy the rewards of that success. Now, from what I hear, I believe the DNR crew, sturgeon are closely managed, as you know. They are very tightly watched. There's a strict limit and quota on the harvest. The season is closed when that quota is reached. And, of course, there's sturgeon watch, which is a citizen involvement activity in the spring when people can go up on the Wolf River and not only watch the sturgeon spawning early in the spring, but help watch over them so that they're not subjected to any poaching or other such problems. But the big prehistoric-looking bottom-feeding fish, they attain tremendous age. And I understand that one of the DNR crews working or marking them last spring released a 240-pounder, which is a really big one.
240 pounds?
Yes. So there are some really big ones out there swimming around, so I'm sure the folks who are into sturgeon spearing are getting pretty excited and getting all their equipment ready, and that whole event gets underway this Saturday. And it is something of a spectator sport, too. So something for everybody this winter.
And where can people get the best information about sturgeon, and especially if they'd like to help protect the sturgeon?
The DNR website and the fisheries department will have information about how people could get involved, for example, in essentially guarding the sturgeon as they're spawning this coming spring. There's certainly information on the spearing season and where people are doing that. And I'm guessing it's such a big event that the communities around Lake Winnebago and so forth probably either have events they're sponsoring or on the community websites would have information on, you know, where to park or go walk out on the ice and watch these people, that kind of thing.
Great. And I want to remind people, I know we've talked about it before, maybe last month, that the DNR has just redesigned their website, and it's much easier to use now. And so I think people can find some really good information and find it more easily on the DNR website, too, which is it DNR.gov?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay. And also, moving from spearing sturgeon to hunting turkeys, turkey permits have been sent out and the extras go on sale in March. How many of those permits are awarded, Scott?
Well, they've been more or less stable over recent years, but there's, in terms of different units amongst the seven or eight that the state is now comprised of, there's a little bit of give and take depending on how turkey numbers are doing. So I think there are a couple of units that were up slightly this year, but there are well over 100,000 permits issued, and there are quite a few tens of thousands left available. So it used to be in the early years when the season got underway in the 80s, if you didn't draw a permit in the lottery, you're kind of out of luck. But in recent years, there have been enough permits available so that there's been a surplus in most of the hunting units. And those go on sale Monday, March 18th by unit. So Unit 1, for example, which is most of southwestern Wisconsin, will go on sale Monday the 18th, Unit 2 on Tuesday the 19th, and so on. There are most of the permits are available for the bigger units in the southern part of the state, but there are no permits left available for the two early hunting periods A and B. So whatever's left is for the later periods, the latter part of the spring. But the important thing is, if you forgot to get in on the deadline, which was last December 10th, and thought you were, oh, I'm out of luck for the turkey season, in fact, you can still buy tags through the website, and the sale that goes on or starts on Monday the 18th.
All right. We're talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He is joining us today from the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation in Dundee, Illinois. And he's happy to take your questions when you call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or a comment on our Facebook page. And Scott, we had a caller who said that she saw a varied thrush near Crivets, and she wonders if that's unusual.
It certainly is. A varied thrush, isn't it? It looks kind of like a robin with a little bit of patchy plumage, but it is an unusual sighting. She sounds very firm in what she saw or found it in a bird book. So, yes, it's an unusual sighting. It's something that folks look not unheard of in Wisconsin, but something, one of many birds that people look forward to that are unusual and help add to their life lists and add to the excitement of birding during the winter.
Well, and that's a nice lead into the Great Backyard Bird Count, which is coming up. How can people get involved with that? And what is it?
Well, let's see. I brought along a little bit of reference information here on that, if I can track it down.
Oh, and I'll let people know that we did put a link to the Great Backyard Bird Count on our Facebook page. And the Facebook page is the Larry Mueller Show, and the website for the Great Backyard Bird Count is birdsource.org. That's birdsource.org, so people can go there. But tell us about the bird count.
Well, anyway, it's an opportunity coming up here in the month of February for folks to yet another of many kind of citizen science activities where folks can sign on to participate, the website you just mentioned, and essentially there's a counting period whereby people report in on what they're seeing at their feeding stations or just in the backyard, essentially, even if they're not feeding. And these data contribute to a very large pool of information collected every year, like the Christmas bird count and other such things that help ornithologists track the health and distribution and abundance of our various bird populations. So another chance for people who are kind of closed in February, wondering what to do to keep an eye out in the backyard and contribute what they're seeing in terms of birds, like that varied thrush, to the backyard bird count.
And just to emphasize that this is, I mean, it's a fun activity, obviously, but it's really important because this is how ornithologists can track trends and spot changes in populations or the range of populations that they simply wouldn't be able to do with the resources that they have available themselves.
Right. They can't do it. The agencies involved in managing our natural resources certainly cannot do it alone, but it's become much more valuable to take advantage of all of the skilled folks who are out there who are excellent birders or interested in herpetology or any other aspect of wildlife who are willing to contribute a little bit of time tracking carnivores, doing all sorts of things that are available in Wisconsin, and that information helps a lot in terms of ultimately management. It makes it better for our wildlife resources and in the long run better for us. And it's no cost. It's just something kind of fun to do.
And you mentioned the birds, and there was a pretty startling figure that's been making the rounds, that new data about birds being killed by cats, and that's both outdoor cats or feral cats who live outdoors all the time and also domestic pets who are let outside. They're estimating that outdoor cats kill between 1.4 billion and 3.7 billion birds a year. And they're saying that one pet cat kills between 1 to 34 birds a year if it's let outside, while a feral cat kills 23 to 46 birds annually. That's a huge number, even on the low end. And they're saying that that's probably a conservative range.
Well, Judith, I'm glad that you reported that and I didn't, because I'm always reluctant to stir the pot on this feral cat issue. But as you stated, with a median number, this is a survey. Actually, it's a computer simulation most recently done by the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And it was essentially research that used a lot of local studies to create a computer model that came up with that median number of 2.4 billion birds. And the majority of that they do attribute to feral cats, essentially homeless cats, if you will, but certainly pet cats that are allowed to roam freely outside. And we've talked about this on the program for decades. It's not a new problem. It hasn't gone away. It's been the subject of lots of controversy, lots of educational efforts, and frankly, it's hard for me to determine what kind of ground we've gained on this. It stirs up some pretty strong emotions on both sides of the fence. On the one hand, you just take a cold, hard, calculated look at the numbers and say, oh my gosh, 2.4 million birds, and I think the mammal median was 12.3 billion mammals.
Right, yeah. Actually, the small mammal numbers like you said, are even higher, ranging from 6.9 billion to 20.7 billion annually.
Now, the argument there, of course, is that a sizable chunk of the mammal numbers are small field rodents, voles, and mice, and so forth, something we'll probably talk later about in regard to homeowner problems this time of year. So, in fact, you could point out, oh, the cats are doing us a service, which that's true, but the collateral damage to other more unusual small mammals that are kind of caught in the crossfire, or those billions of birds, it's hard to look at those numbers in an objective way and say, and not come to the conclusion that this is a problem that's just got to be dealt with. However, there have also been some interesting papers and thought pieces written lately that the rather dry recitation of facts like those big numbers are not compelling evidence for folks who whose behavior in relation to feral cats has really developed over a lifetime of experiences, from childhood experiences to family life to formal education to religious beliefs, outdoor experiences, you name it. All of these things go into shaping what some folks believe about contentious issues, and really no amount of factual reporting is going to change that. So for those of us who are concerned about the impacts of feral cats, there has to be some new sort of scheme. And feral cats aren't alone. I would lump into this kind of thing that's difficult to deal with from a, hey, here are the facts, you've got to believe this kind of thing. I mean, think about response to global warming information. Think about response to evidence about evolution. There are probably some other good examples, but feral cats happen to be a big one in the wildlife community. But the bottom line is, here's yet another study that says we're losing a lot of wildlife to a source that we as humans really could do something about if we generated the proper spirit and mindset to do it. So whether this will stir up any controversy or not remains to be seen. I've become reluctant to even talk sometimes, but we'll see.
Well, we're glad that you're willing to talk about it, Scott. Wildlife ecologist Scott Craven joining us today. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in today for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Wisconsin wildlife with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. And Scott, you mentioned moles and voles and mice as some of the small mammals that those feral cats and domestic cats might be taking care of when they're out there. There's been a lot of vole and field mice activity this winter. What does that mean for homeowners?
Well, I think now that we've got snow cover again in most of the state, people need to be a little vigilant. I mean, we tend to not go outside and look around very much this time of year, but it's worth, if you've got some dwarf fruit trees, you know, woody vegetation around the house, especially in mulched landscape beds, or even a garage or outbuilding that you don't get into very often, it's worth keeping a watchful eye out for signs of mouse activity. The little guys, especially the white-footed or deer mice, the cute little guys with the big eyes and the white bellies, can chew their way into virtually anything. And although they are a little cute and they're native field rodents as opposed to house mice or rats, in the building they can cause all sorts of problems, gnawing on things. And if they get into, probably the easiest way to figure out you've got them, if you've got pets and there's any food or bird seed stored in the garage, and you go out to put on your pair of boots to shovel snow one of these nights, and the boot's full of either shell corn or sunflower seeds or dog kibble, that's a pretty good sign that the mice are in there. And it would probably be a good idea at that point to start running a little snap trap line or whatever your tool of choice is to get rid of them and get them out of there, because they can do some significant damage. They'll get into drawers and tear up paperwork and shred it to make nests. They'll get into stored cars, stored boats. Well, I'll give you a pretty good story in my own case. We hadn't had any snow this fall until that big storm just before Christmas. And late last year, I had purchased a very nice, boy, I've got a really big, high-powered, fancy snowblower, and I was just really excited about finally getting to use it. So I went out to the garage and the barn, and there sits the snowblower, shiny and bright red, just the way it came off the showroom floor. And I tried to start it up, and it would start perfectly and then just go and die. And that caused a great deal of anxiety, considering what I paid for it. And finally, I tried everything I could think of. I couldn't get the thing started. So I hauled it into a local dealer and described the situation. Yeah, we'll have a look. Called me back within an hour and said, say, there's nothing wrong with your snowblower. I said, well, what do you mean? It won't start. Oh, no, he said it starts and runs fine. Once I took the seeds out of the carburetor, it was just fine. So when I got over there, he had a Ziploc bag with probably a half a pound of what appeared to me to be the pits of black cherries. and there's a black cherry tree right next to the garage, but one or more industrious mice had somehow hauled, probably individually, about 5,000 black cherry pits, and they were packed so tight into the engine of that snowblower that nothing could work. There was nothing wrong with it until he cleaned all that out.
Wow, and you had never used it, so obviously...
Right, so yeah. So for some time since between last winter and just before Christmas, an industrious mouse or mice stuffed it full of seeds. So there can be some pretty serious and frustrating consequences from not dealing with these mice, and from what I'm seeing in the yard for vole activity or field mouse, these are the stubby little short guys with the short tails, as opposed to the white-bellied, big-eared, big-eyes guys that get in the house. Both can cause their share of problems. I'm simply suggesting that since they seem to be very active this winter, that look around at things you might not normally check. And if you see signs of mouse problems, try and deal with them. Otherwise, if you wait till spring, they'll only be that much worse.
All right. We have a call from Anne in Madison, so let's go there. Hi, Anne.
Hello.
What's your question?
We have a cabin on the Fox River, and we had before Christmas, before the river froze, we had a river otter come out from playing along the marsh across the river, and he the second time we saw him, the second weekend we saw him in December, mid-December or the weekend before the river froze before Christmas. And he came over to our side of the river and was along the edge of the ice and, came up on the ice and scampered away. Well, the river froze, and there was a little bit of little opening of water still where the boat landing comes in and the muck in front of our river, in front of our cabin, I'm sorry. And there was a little part of open water, probably a foot or 2 feet long. And he came across from the milkweeds, or cattails, I'm sorry. And he went down and he, caught a fish and came scampering back to the cattails. And then he did this several times, always catching a fish before he went back. Well, that was a Saturday. Well, Sunday, overnight, we had the temperatures just dropped, and that little open spot froze up. So the next morning when we saw him go out, he went over and he went across the boat landing and still could find no open water. And he scampered back to the cattails. And I'm wondering, where do they ever go into hibernation, or, what does it eat when there are no fish for him to catch.
Well, they're very attractive animals. I mean, people love, as you've indicated, love to watch them, but they can cover considerable distances, and in all likelihood, especially along a river, that animal will just move up or down the river until it finds a little patch of open water or finds something with a crack or hole where it can enlarge it a bit with its teeth and get in there to catch a fish. So otters are very resourceful, very mobile animals, and it may hole up. If it's bitter cold, it may hole up in some cover for a day or two, but it will find a way to get in the water somewhere along that river.
All right. Thanks for that call, Anne. And you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We have some open lines, so we can get you on pretty quickly. And Gail in Fish Creek is next. Hi, Gail.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
As someone that has been involved in the cat population issue, we've tried to work at the trap neuter return programs and have really come up against not getting the funding or enough people involved because the big issue is we can't get farmers to help us by letting us go in and grab their cats. There's no programs, there's no grant funding that we can really get a hold of, and now with the numbers showing up with this study showing how many birds are gone now because of the feral cat thing. Do you think we might be able to get to a common ground and get some grant money and start working more formally to start to do a humane approach to reducing the cat population in every state, and but of course in Wisconsin and of course in our county, because we've been trying a little grassroots to do it, and there's people that are trying to do it. And then my other question was about snakes can climb trees and go after birds. So not that it's all been snakes, but I'd like to know some of your views on that, and also about if we can rely on you guys to help us champion for grants to help spay, neuter, and return.
Well, that's a very well-stated question and concern, Gail. I appreciate it. Let me deal with the snake and other issues first. Certainly, there are all sorts of things that impact bird populations. Many quite natural aspects of predation, disease, starvation, and so forth. It's not just snakes. Even squirrels will eat bird eggs, possums, raccoons, you name it. Birds are very abundant and relatively prolific, and lots of things take advantage of them early in life as eggs or nestlings, fledglings, and so forth. Even other birds eat birds, like the Cooper's hawk that's set up residence in my backyard the last week or so. So all of that goes into the reality that if all bird eggs laid produced a healthy, free-flying adult bird, we'd be overwhelmed pretty quickly with sub-bird populations. So yes, there are lots of other things that kill birds, including many man-made things, whether it's roadkill, window kill, transmission towers, power lines, pollution, toxicants, and a whole host of other things that humans are responsible for. The only difference, at least in my mind, or the only consideration that sways me a bit in the cat situation is that cats are not, they're certainly an important pet and companion animal and very important in many people's lives. And I know lots of my fellow biologists who have cats, but to a person, they're all indoor cats. No problem there. But cats, the reality is they are an exotic, somewhat invasive species that are only here on this continent, again, because of human activity. In other words, we brought them here as companion animals. And then whether they were released, escaped, or they're simply let out the back door, we've also introduced them to the environment as well as our homes. And therefore, I think they fall into a slightly different category in terms of the responsibility that we have toward sound management of cat populations. What you suggest in terms of the TNR, the Trap, Neuter, Release program, is certainly a step in the right direction, and it's great that there are a lot of people committed to that. But even that program is a bit contentious. I guess I'd have to say that there's quite a wide spectrum of views across the cat situation, from those that, hey, this is no problem, you know, we'll feed feral cat colonies, whatever, don't worry about it, to those who want every last cat removed from the environment, and then some middle ground type approaches like the trap, neuter, release situation. I guess the basic answer to your question is, with these new numbers, will this stir a new wave of interest in feral cat management that might bring people together? I can only hope so. I don't know. The numbers are relatively new. We'll see what happens. Some of the controversy also surrounds the TNR program itself, in that I think for some folks thinking logically about this, now wait a minute, if we've actually got our hands on the cat, rather than neuter it and put it back in the population where it is still going to eat and continue to kill birds, isn't that an opportunity to simply remove the cat from the population? So there's that aspect of it as well. In addition to the simple biology involved, that such a high percentage of a cat population needs to be neutered before there's a measurable impact on reproduction, that's also a problem. But all that aside, hopefully the numbers will stimulate a new wave of discussion, perhaps some more cooperation, and maybe free up some funding sources, as you said you so desperately need, and we'll see where it all takes us. But this is not a new front on the wildlife management scene. It's been around for a long time.
Thanks for that, Scott. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist with us today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller, and you can join the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And let's go to Bill in New Berlin next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. This situation arose about 3 weeks ago. A mouse got into our apartment, and I live in a relatively brand-new apartment complex, and I live very clean. There's never any exposed or open food in my apartment, etc. Anyway, this mouse got in, and my son saw him, and quite frankly, I didn't believe him because I couldn't see how a mouse could survive in our place. But a week later, I spotted the mouse scampering through my bedroom, out into the hall, and into my son's bedroom. I reported it to the management, and they said they gave me 3 traps to catch the mouse, and they said that it has a sweetener in it that is like cheesecake to mice, and so we would surely catch him. Well, 3 days went by, and neither of us saw him again, and he did not go into a trap. So I called the landlord and said, I think we need an exterminator. And she said, well, she checked with our maintenance man. He said that the mouse probably left the apartment because it couldn't find anything to eat. That was during that really bitter cold snap.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering, is the mouse still in the apartment? I haven't seen him since, neither has my son.
All right, let's see what Scott has to say. Scott, what do you think?
Well, there's really no way to answer that question. A mouse that... first of all, they don't have tremendous needs in terms of food. I mean, it wouldn't take much more than a misplaced cracker that fell down behind the couch to keep it going for a while, and their moisture needs are not great either. The problem is it makes a fair bit of difference in a setting like that, a clean, well-kept apartment in a relatively new building. One has to wonder, first of all, how the heck did the mouse get in there, and then what kind of a mouse is it? If it's a house mouse, which is the aforementioned exotic pest species, beady little eyes, gray all the way around, those animals will live out their entire life within someone's kitchen, apartment, home, barn, or whatever. That's not the kind of a mouse that when spring warms up, like a white-footed mouse, the white-bellied ones, is going to want to be back outside. They're only in our garages, homes, and so forth for winter shelter. So that makes a little bit of difference. If it's a house mouse, I'd be a little more concerned than if it's a transient white-footed mouse that just found a way in along on the utility cable or a pipe opening or something. It may be gone. It may not be gone. There's not much to them. It's quite possible it could have died back in a corner under an appliance and mummified, and the smell of that may or may not have been detectable. I mean, you may never see it again, and then find this dried-up mouse remains, you know, somewhere deep in the distant future. On the other hand, it may have simply found its way out the way it came in. If you don't see it again and it's not causing any problems, I guess I wouldn't be too worried about it. But if you do see it again, then what I didn't catch was what kind of a trap did they give you? Was it just a plain old snap-type mouse trap?
No, it was a little small plastic box that they said had sweetener in it.
Well, all well and good, but mouse traps are kind of like a few other things in society that people have been trying to improve upon them for generations and have been not very successful at it. If you see the mouse again, get yourself just a plain old wooden-based snap-type trap at the local hardware or grocery store, sit it along a wall or a corner or wherever you see the animal, and bait the little trigger pan with peanut butter. And there's no better combination for removing mice than that one. And even if you miss it, the trap is sprung or the peanut butter is gone, then take a little twist tie or a little tiny piece of cloth and tightly wrap or tie that around the trigger so that you can actually smear the peanut butter into it. Otherwise, that's just a little metal plate, and if the mouse is fairly delicate about it, they can lick the peanut butter off, especially in the warmth of a home, and not spring the trap. So, but that way you'd at least know the animal is still there if the peanut butter disappears. So at least for this point, unless you see it again, I wouldn't be too concerned about it.
All right. Thanks for that call, Bill. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, is our guest today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up tomorrow at 11, tax day is just a couple months away, and CPA Dale Kunin will answer your questions and share important tax advice for preparing your tax returns. Today we're talking with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. And Scott, we had a question on the Facebook page from Tad. He saw a doe in a field a couple of weeks ago with floppy ears. He's wondering if that would be from an injury, illness, or just genetics.
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, the ears on a deer are usually rather erect. I don't know. I guess I've never heard that observation before. Whether it's a matter of it could be injury, but it could also be where did he say where the deer was?
He didn't. Just in a field.
Yeah. You know, there are so many issues going around now between chronic wasting disease and the EHD outbreak is long over with colder weather, but there are certainly a number of things that affect deer, CWD being one of them, and with the debilitating impacts of that particular problem, whether it causes the ears to flop a bit or not, I don't know. I mean, it would seem like the cartilage is sort of a fixed element that keeps that ear in place, and I'm not sure the disease would impact that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose it's possible it was some sort of a genetic anomaly, too. I just don't know. It must have looked a little strange, actually.
Right.
It looked like a deer with a Labrador Retriever head on.
Maybe that's the issue.
I don't know. I've never seen that, and don't know what to say about it. But we can always turn to our very highly skilled and observant audience to
yes.
see if anyone else has seen it.
Right, and it would seem also that injury wouldn't be likely if it was both ears.
It doesn't seem.
You know. So, unless it's a really unlucky deer. But, speaking of deer, where did we end up for the deer harvest?
Well, the numbers are pretty much in, and let's see. Yeah, this was as of about a week ago. Basically, the harvest was up about 5% over 2011. And the total deer harvested or killed over over all the state seasons was about almost 367,000 animals, compared with 348,000 animals in 2011. 245,000 plus during the traditional 9-day November gun hunt, 93,000 during the archery season, and all in all, it was a great deer season. I just didn't. It was nice to see those deer harvested, but it was especially nice to just not hear as much grumbling from the hunting community as seems to have been the case for the past couple of years. People seemed much happier with the way things went, with the regulations and with the harvest. Mm-hmm. So all is currently reasonably well with the deer world, sort of, or at least it's quiet. I don't know about well, but at least it's quiet.
Well, and are there goals for how many deer, you know, the deer management folks want to see harvested?
Well, there certainly are. Each deer management unit in the state has stated population goals, and then the harvest goals essentially are derived from that. But as part of the series of recommendations from the so-called Deer Czar or James Kroll report last summer, the agency's gotten away from kind of the numbers game of predicting before the season, well, this is how many deer we have, this is how many will probably be killed, should be killed, or whatever. And that notion of focusing on numbers has been de-emphasized in favor of overall satisfaction with the hunting experience and minimizing deer damage and other problems in other ways. So it's difficult to say at this point where that number may have fit into what people who are responsible for these kinds of things were thinking. But bottom line is it was up. So from the hunter's perspective and the agency's perspective, where deer numbers have been above goal for quite a long time, that's all good.
Great. We have quite a few people waiting to talk with you, Scott, so let's go back to the phones. And Deborah in Brown Deer is next. Hi, Deborah.
I have a photograph that I took this summer of I'm almost positive it's a mink, and there's like a little, it's not the South Branch Creek, but it's like a tributary, or I'm not exactly sure like what the body of water is, but it's just a little, it's a little tiny creek, maybe even like self-manufactured as a wetland area and near the City Hall in Brown's Ear. And I noticed it blends in with the rocks, and I got two pictures of it. And I don't have a computer, but I'll try to get it up to the library and get it on the Facebook page. But I wondered, is there a mate with that mink someplace, or would they live singly?
Well, there certainly may be other mink around. Well, without seeing it, we can't tell for sure, but I assume it was an elongated, fairly small animal, kind of chocolate brown in color.
Yes.
Did you happen to get a look? Could you see it very well?
Yes, I have a really good photo of it. I was so happy and proud of it. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, and then I ID'd it, it made me realize it's absolutely a mink, or I think it is absolutely mink, is the show on PBS on minks, and I don't think it's an otter. But what are the differences between otters and minks?
Well, an otter's many times larger than a mink. But did you see on its throat, did it have a white or cream-colored spot on its throat?
I have to get it.
An otter, they're built the same way. They're both members of the weasel family, but an otter is many times larger. I guess, you know, a mink is a little bit bigger than a gray squirrel. They have a pretty good-sized tail. They're beautiful, rich, luxurious. Most of the wild mink chocolate brown, although they come in a lot of colors, especially if it's an escaped domestic animal. That's about all. There's no question along a stream of the members of the weasel family, that's the most likely one you would have seen, especially slinking in and around the rocks. So, but whether how many there are, whether a mate was nearby or whatever, impossible to tell, but possible.
All right. Thanks for that call, Deborah. And I do hope you'll get that up on the Facebook page, because it would be great to see that mink photo. Mike in Hartford is up next. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I was just listening to your story about the snowblower and can relay another one that's pretty funny. I have a boat that I store in an outdoor metal pole shed building, and it's an open 20-foot fishing boat, and I have a very, very large musky net in it that's probably a 36-inch diameter with about a close to a 4-foot deep net basket made out of a nylon-coated heavy material. Well, long story short, I went out to do some maintenance on my boat one day in spring, and I climb up in the boat, and here I notice that the entire netting is gone. Not any pieces laying around, nothing. All that's there is the handle and the hoop. It's as though somebody went in there with the scissors and just cut it off and stole it. It was nowhere to be found. 5 years later, I sell my home and move, and I lift about a half a sheet of plywood up off the floor that had a tool chest on top of it over a gravel floor, and lo and behold, here is the entire net totally intact, but just sheared off of the hoop, and I would assume these were probably Norway field rats that chewed this thing off and somehow managed to drag it out of the boat, over the sides, down onto the floor, and then tuck it underneath that piece of plywood, dig tunnels and bury it and use it as a nest.
Wow.
Well, you have to give rodents credit for industriousness, perseverance, and physical capabilities, especially larger ones like rats. So their ability to climb and swim and dig and chew and everything is legendary. But even the smaller ones, there are a few things in nature more powerful than the jaw strength of a rodent, and they're sharp too. So it doesn't surprise me that they cut it off, but dragging it across a rough surface like a boat must have been quite a challenge for them. I usually, just trying to grab my net to net a fish, it's tangled up in half a dozen different things before I can actually get it in the water.
Well, maybe it was part of the Rat Olympics.
Could be.
Well, and I'm guessing, Mike, that you disappointed the rats, because if they were trying to play hide and seek with you, you never went looking for it.
Soon looking for a new home, because they were still in there. They scattered to the wind when I picked that
up.
And
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's quite a story. Thanks for sharing that, Mike. We'd love to hear your wildlife stories, too, if you'd like to join us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Jennifer Dargan, our on-air producer today. And let's go next to Anna in Harbor Springs, Michigan. Hi, Anna.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if there's anything in the Midwest that could be confused with a very large cat like puma or mountain lion, since we do know now, since they've been killed here, we know they're here, in terms of print tracks, the prints, the tracks.
Sure. Scott?
Well, our native, as far as actual cats, we have, of course, house cats, feral cats, a small round track, not a great deal different than what you might see as a fox track. And then when you get to the next largest size, bobcats, which are reasonably common and widely distributed, lynx, which are related, a little bit larger, but very unusual. And then, of course, cougar tracks, which are, you know, almost the size of your hand. Mm. But still, all cat tracks are round in outline and generally don't show claw marks. And I'm not sure what to... What do you, Anna, what have you seen or thought you might have seen or...
I have a friend who lives on 10 acres, lots of wood, and it is adjacent to more wooded area. And I've definitely been out with her and seen bear tracks, but she was on her own the other day and saw what she thinks is, she called it a puma, but cougar track, because it was about, the center pad was about 4 or so inches in diameter, and the 4 little digits in front of it were, it was all together. She said it was about a 6-inch print.
That's possible. And of course, as you said up front, cougars, pumas, mountain lions, whatever you wish to call them, have been well documented now, primarily moving through the area, through northern Wisconsin, southern Wisconsin, the UP, and so on. And both agencies, I assume the Michigan DNR is as into this or on top of it as the Wisconsin DNR. So, and your neighbor seems to know her tracks. So this is a case where you photograph the track, if it's still there, or if she did, preferably with a coin or a piece of a ruler or something in it or near it for size reference, and then get that to the local DNR office. And they've often already started a sequence of either sightings, track reports, or whatever else to plot the movements of these animals across the landscape. So I certainly couldn't rule it out.
Great. Thanks for that call, Anna. And actually, Scott, that brings up a more general question of, if we see tracks in the snow, what are some things to focus in on to try to determine what they might have been made by?
Well, it's one of the things, if we talk later about things to do here in the dead of winter when otherwise life is a little slow, getting out on fresh tracks and following the animals around is really kind of cool. As we left here this morning to go up to the shooting range for that exercise, there were some beautiful sets of raccoon tracks in the parking lot and quite a few deer tracks. And, of course, once you've found the track and have identified it, then it's kind of fun to follow it along and, hey, what was that animal up to under the cover of darkness last night? So it is a fun thing to do and get some exercise and get outside and see what's around. It might surprise you. The tricky part is that identification of some of the more unusual tracks is not that easy, unless the snow conditions or mud or whatever are perfect to give a perfect imprint. Just finding a track, especially if it's kind of blurry and soft snow, can be kind of a challenge. Now, fortunately, there are some great books available. My favorite is Mammal Tracks and Sign by Mark Elbrock, Elbrock. The wonderful book on interpreting all kinds of animal sign, from tracks to droppings to dens and scuff mark, anything you can think of. So that's a nice reference. There's also field guides to animal tracks, many different types. So armed with that and a little bit of experience, and maybe going out with somebody who knows their tracks really well, you can start to pick up on most of the common ones fairly easily. Fox, cat, raccoon, deer, of course, is very easy with the hoof marks. But then when you start to get into some of the members of the weasel family, a number of toes, five in the case of the weasel, four in a dog track, and so forth, it can become quite a challenge. And if you document or develop your own set of track illustrations or sketches or photographs, you can get pretty good at it, and a lot of people do. But it's not quite as easy as it might seem up front. And all the little bitty tracks that you see from the shrews and voles and mice and so forth scooting from one little tuft of grass to another, those are very difficult to interpret.
Well, we will talk more about what to do outdoors in the winter, including following tracks, when we are back after the news with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. He joins us once a month to talk about Wisconsin's wildlife. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay tuned. The diversity and richness of Wisconsin wildlife is one of the many things that make our state such a special place to live and that bring visitors from all over. And you don't even need to head to the forests or lakes of northern Wisconsin. You can go sit in a local park or even your own backyard and see more than you might think. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're lucky to have wildlife ecologist Scott Craven as our guide to the outdoors. He has great ideas for ways to enjoy the outdoors and to be good stewards of nature. Do you have a question about our wildlife, or are you wondering about an interesting animal behavior you observed? You can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. And I hope you'll visit our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. Click like while you're there to get regular updates on upcoming show topics and links to useful resources. We'll be back to talk about Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven right after the news. Hi, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. Each year that I live in Wisconsin, and I'm actually coming up on 25 years this year, I develop a deeper and deeper appreciation for our wildlife. And getting to listen to Scott Craven explain their behaviors and give tips on what to watch for has certainly made me much more observant. Scott comes by once a month to talk about the cycles of nature in Wisconsin, and we're happy to have him with us today. He's joining us from the Max McGraw Wildlife Foundation in Dundee, Illinois. Thanks, as always, for spending time with us, Scott.
You're more than welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we have a bunch of people who want to talk with you, Scott, so let's go right back to the phones and Jane in Fitchburg. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Well, this question is a little bit out of season, but the mouse question a while back reminded me of it. First, is there a difference between a chipmunk and a 13-line ground squirrel?
They're two completely different animals, just like there's a difference between the gray squirrel and a chipmunk. So two different species, their behaviors are somewhat different. They both basically are ground-dwelling ground squirrels, so they're related in that sense, and they're both rodents, but they both are essentially down for the winter, but they have a little bit of different behavior in the summer.
Well, I am plagued with one of them. Well, I'm not sure which kind it is, but in the area where I have my bird feeders, which is fenced off from my dogs so the dogs can't get the birds, but that makes it a really nice place for these critters to go. And I've tried a number of different things, rat traps and the smoke bombs, and I recently was using those one-inch cubes of mouse bait, and I don't know if that was effective or not yet, but I'm wondering if you have any better ideas, or if you think that the mouse bait would do it.
Well, I probably wouldn't use the mouse bait. It's too non-selective, especially if you were just sort of putting it out on the ground. There are some rodent baits that if you found the animal's burrows, that you could place it directly in the burrow and perhaps improve your success. But both of those animals, chipmunk or the ground squirrel, are very vulnerable to a plain old-fashioned rat trap baited with peanut butter. The tricky part, of course, is to place the trap such that it's not going to be pecked on by a blue jay or something else that likes peanut butter, or, you know, a child or one of your dogs or anything else that might get after it. But I think the first thing to determine is which one you have, and there really shouldn't be much question about it. The ground squirrel is a lighter beige in color. They're kind of longer and skinnier and slink around close to the ground and have, as the name suggests, 13 stripes or rows of dots on their back, whereas the chipmunk is a little more rusty brown, a little chunkier, and just has basically the two white stripes bordered by black down their back. So if you get a look at it, it shouldn't be any problem determining which one you have, but it wouldn't surprise me a great deal if you have both. But either way, I think the trap is a better alternative to the to just random placement of a rodenticide. And number two, as far as trap choice, if you really don't want to kill them, then they can certainly also be caught in a small live trap, a small wire live trap, again, baited with peanut butter and sunflower seeds or something that they seem to like.
All right. Thanks for that call, Jane. And let's now go to Holly in the Milwaukee area, who also has a rodent question. Hi, Holly.
Hi. My question involves a neighbor, and I'm in a neighborhood where we have 1 to 3 acres, each of us, and it's fairly decent, so he stands out because he does not mow his lawn, and he calls himself a minimalist. And when I talked to him about it, yeah, I thought that was funny. It was kind of tongue-in-cheek, but seriously, he said that would keep the rodents from coming in the home if he's not destroying their natural habitat. Is that sound reasoning?
What do you think, Scott?
Not entirely. You know, sometimes in a setting like that, folks just sort of give up mowing the lawn in the name of prairie restoration, for example. But the way to restore a prairie is not to just stop mowing a bluegrass lawn. That just doesn't work. The reality of the situation is it's probably a mixed bag. Abandoning 1, 2, or 3 acres and letting the vegetation grow very thick and rank would, for example, be very discouraging for the 13-line ground squirrels that we just mentioned. They like short grass and open spaces, so it might discourage them. On the other hand, tall, rank grass and just essentially abandonment, it could provide a home for all kinds of field mice, voles, shrews, and who knows what else. So the bottom line is, on balance, I think it's probably abandonment like that probably creates more habitat for a wider variety of small mammals than the well-maintained lawn.
Well, and it sounded like the neighbor was saying that if he left his lawn untended, that the rodents would be happy and stay out there instead of going into his house. Is there any reason to think that would be the case, Scott?
No. The reality is, I think that activity or that land management strategy would create a higher population of rodents, which probably accentuates the opportunity mm-hmm. for either different species or more rodents to find entrance. If you use me as a case of point, my house is in the middle of 10 acres of restored prairie. It's wonderful small mammal habitat, and the fact that there's all sorts of habitat does not discourage the mice from stuffing my snowblower full of seeds at all.
Not that you're bitter.
Not that I'm bitter about that at all. So this is kind of a tough one because in some cases, you know, we biologists, ecologists, and so forth, would like to see more natural landscaping as opposed to closely manicured lawns for the benefit of everything from birds to small mammals and snakes and assorted other things. So on the one hand, you say, well, that's sort of a good thing, but I think I think it does potentially result in some friction with the neighbors, which may be the case here, and it may actually make things a little more problematic for the homeowner who goes that way, the way I have. But if the homeowner is willing to put up with those aggravated problems on their own, then the issue is more of a neighbor relations, neighborhood association kind of thing, and that's not my turf.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a little detour away from the small mammals, the rodents. I think we'll probably touch on them again before the end of the program, but I want to go to the opposite end of the spectrum and talk about bears. What do we know about the state bear population right now?
Well, the only news on the bear front is that it seems right now, and there are a couple of research studies underway or in progress. Early reports suggest that maybe the bear population is down a bit from that. You recall 5 years ago, there was a very high estimate of the bear population as a result of an ingenious study using tetracycline marked bacon and a mark recapture study of the bears. And the population estimate went from 14,000-15,000 up to, holy cow, there might be 30 or 35,000. I think that's been ratcheted back a bit now to perhaps 20,000 or less. And as a result of that, the harvest permits for bears may drop down by a few hundred or so. I think that's yet to be determined, even though interest in the form of bear hunters or applicants for bear harvest permits is still way up. It seems like the bear population has retrenched a little bit from a few years ago. So,
and do you think that's anything to be concerned about? Or
no, not at all.
Just a natural cycle?
We still have a very high bear population in Wisconsin, so there's still lots of bears out there.
Great. And Spring Conservation Congress hearings are coming up. What do you expect will be covered at those?
Well, we've got a little time to think about that for folks who are interested in attending those. It's always a good event in citizen conservation and democracy. The Conservation Congress hearings are held in every county throughout the state this year on Monday, April 8th in the evening, and it's usually well posted which, you know, high school auditorium or community center the meetings will be held in. And then there are a series of proposals discussed on hunting, trapping, fishing, other outdoor issues, some put forth by the DNR, some put forth by the Congress. There are other ways to get information on the docket, and then how the people in attendance feel about these things by way of vote is reported back to the DNR and the DNR board in an advisory way as decisions and regulations are made on these issues. It's a ways away, and we may talk about this again before it happens, but there aren't any really hot-button topics. You may recall over the years things like dove hunting a few years ago. That really brought out a crowd. Some of the cat proposals a few years ago were pretty contentious. Doesn't seem to be anything like that on the docket this time around, but there's quite a series of wildlife and fisheries questions. Most are local in focus. There's one about the use of tree stands, however, hunting tree stands on public lands in Wisconsin, where there may be a change in the works from longstanding policy that they had to be removed every day to perhaps allowing them to be placed and left overnight. And we'll see how that plays out. But those are the kinds of things that folks attending the Conservation Congress hearings can talk about. It's open to anyone. You don't have to be a hunter or fisher or whatever. You can go and voice your opinion on these things.
And we'll make sure that we get that list of dates and locations up on the Facebook page, and I'm sure we'll talk about it before that's coming up. And, Scott, we had a question from a listener wondering about the recent wolf hunt, and the caller heard that a wolf was taken that weighed 212 pounds.
Well, wow, that's a big one. There's been a plethora of photos on the internet and rumors like this. The reality of the situation, I'm not sure what the largest one taken was, but there was one photo circulating of a wolf that allegedly weighed 165 pounds, let alone 212.
Right.
So I turned to my good friend Adrian, who's kind of run the wolf program for quite a while for the DNR and has handled many wolves. And his comment to me was, well, you know, he personally have been involved in the handling and collaring and so forth. It was somewhere around 600 individual wolves in Wisconsin over the years. And the largest individual wolf that they had handled was 108 pounds.
So, yeah, 212 was not.
212 seems like the person with the wolf might have been standing on the scale at the same time.
Or maybe there was a second wolf hiding behind. All right. Well, let's go back to the phones and Norman in Wausau. Hi, Norman.
Hi. I wanted to make a suggestion to those people who find that they just can't get rid of mice, especially those in their attic. We have about a 40-year-old home, and other than when it was built, we never had any mouse problems until about 6 years ago. And then every night during the wintertime when I'd use the bathroom, I'd hear the scurrying around up in the attic. And I couldn't figure out how they got in because our house, I closed every opening that I could think of by one method or another. Couldn't see anything until one day I was up in the attic with a carpenter. We were going to do something up there, and I noticed that right along the ridge line, there was about a 4-inch wide bunch of maple seeds with the seeds gone, but they still had the little impeller thing on them all the way along the ridge line. And we went out on the roof, and lo and behold, there were holes underneath the ridge vent that kind of a plastic grid they got to keep out bugs and everything else, which chewed through in a number of places. And when we pulled the ridge vent off, lo and behold, there were mouse pellets there. So what we did, we took aluminum screening and put it all the way along the ridge line and then put a new ridge vent on. And guess what? We haven't had any more mouse problems in the attic since, which has been 3 years ago.
Well, there you go.
Good job. A ridge vent, where utility cables come in, where flashing meets the chimney, soffits, there are all sorts of access points that rodents can use. Ridge vent is a particularly problematic one. That was the access point for bats in our cabin up in Price County a couple summers ago. So bottom line is, in order to really defeat the mice, you have to really do a meticulous search of your home and understand where the potential access points are, whether it's ridge vent or a number of other things, and make sure those are secure. And then if you do that and you're vigilant about it, you can really minimize your mouse problems, as Norman did there.
And know that they can come in a much smaller opening than you would ever think possible.
It really doesn't take much bigger than a dime to let a house mouse in. And when you think about those fantastically powerful and sharp incisors, they're quite capable of making their own hole.
Well, and we had an email from Conrad in Mineral Point. He asks, would half-inch hardware cloth be small enough to block both chipmunks and mice?
Half-inch, yeah. I'm trying to sort this out with my... Given the option, I'd go to 3/8 or a quarter, just to be on the safe side.
He was worried that a quarter inch was too light a gauge for the crawl space vent.
Well, I mean, you could even back the two of them to increase the strength, but minimize the gap. So there are probably possibilities there, but half, I guess I'd have to look at a piece of half, but I think the diagonal on half inch would be a little more than half inch. I'm thinking a small mouse might be able to get through that.
So it might stop the chipmunks, but not the mice.
It would stop the chipmunks for sure.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones, and Lois in DeForest is next. Hi, Lois.
Hi. I have a question that I've been waiting for Scott to maybe address, but I haven't heard it today. I wonder if he could share with us what variety of wildlife we might find in Wisconsin wetlands.
What wildlife in wetlands? Well, let's see, where to start? Wetlands are a very important community type for a whole host of ecological reasons and home to a wealth of wildlife. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to think of things that don't use wetlands.
Mm-hmm.
First and foremost, wetlands are critically important to amphibians. So virtually all of our amphibian species are going to be found nearer in wetlands, the frogs and toads and salamanders and so forth. A fair number of the reptiles, including most of the turtles, some of the snakes, a multitude of birds, ranging from waterfowl and shorebirds, on up to a variety of songbirds that use the cattails and perimeter and so forth. And then all sorts of mammals that are not necessarily aquatic, like muskrats and mink and water shrews in the north, but virtually everything else that would come there for a drink or to take a bath or what have you. So to be honest, I'm running through my mind and thinking about what kind of an animal would never be found in a wetland, and I'm having trouble coming up with anything.
Well, and I just want to recommend, Lois, that you check the website for the Wisconsin Wetlands Association. It's a great organization that we have on quite frequently talking about the different issues facing wetlands and how critical they are for all of us and for the animals that live there. And their website is wisconsinwetlands.org, and Wisconsin is spelled out. So wisconsinwetlands.org. And certainly from having them on, I've really come to appreciate how much work our wetlands do to keep the environment healthy for all of us. All right, let's go next to Dick in Richland Center. Hi, Dick.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Last fall, I went down to my garage, and there was an animal running away from the garage towards the woods that I've never seen before. It had really nice-looking fur and a long foot-and-a-half rat tail, and it was about the size of a beaver. And I thought, I had no idea what it was.
Was it dark in color?
Yeah, it was darker in color.
And this long tail wasn't really naked like a rat tail, but had fur on it.
No, it was naked.
Hmm.
It wasn't a possum?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I have beavers not too far from me, and I thought, well, this could be a beaver, but there's no way with that tail.
So it was, it was a pretty chunky, rotund animal, or was it?
Yeah, I would say it was a good size, like a beaver, about 20 pounds. And then I went on the Internet and checked around and came up with an animal called a nutria.
Well, you know, a big animal with a naked tail, nutria is the first thing that would come to mind. But good grief, I certainly hope we haven't found any of those in Wisconsin. They're more of a southern, it's a South American rodent, actually, that was brought into some southern coastal marshes in this country as a source of fur. They essentially look like a giant muskrat. And they've escaped, of course, as most animal plans like that go awry. So they become a huge management problem in a number of coastal areas in the southern states and up the east coast, and I think even in some areas on the west coast. But, boy, I sure haven't heard of any in Wisconsin yet, and I hope that wasn't the case. But it is a big animal, much larger than muskrat, and does have a naked tail. But, I'd have to call that a long shot and think that maybe it's something a little less unusual, but perhaps with some type of mange or skin problem that may have taken the hair off its tail or caused it some other problems. I thought you were headed with dark color and a long tail. I thought you might be headed toward a fisher, which is a possibility, but they don't have a naked tail by any means, and it's a pretty distinctive lope and dark chestnut color as far as coloration. So I'm not, bottom line, Dick, I'm not sure what you saw, but I sure hope, I mean, the description does fit a nutria, but I sure hope it wasn't a nutria.
Well, thanks for that call, Dick. And Scott, we have just about a minute left. If people are interested in finding some things to do outdoors during the winter, what's a good source for that?
Well, a couple of quick plugs. First of all, I mean, you couldn't beat going to the Garden Expo this Saturday.
That's true.
So the Garden Expo in Madison this Saturday, coming up here in a few weeks on March 2nd, on that weekend, that will be Leopold weekend, and there'll be lots of Leopold readings around the state. I'll be doing a reading at the UW Arboretum. So there's a couple Saturday activities, the snow tracking and so forth that we talked about a little earlier. But also something else I'd like people to think about, there are conservation groups having their banquets this time of year. And Pheasants Forever banquet's coming up. There's a Wild Turkey Federation banquet coming up in the Madison area. But these are held throughout Wisconsin. Find out where a local banquet's going on and go out. It's a nice night out. There's usually lots of raffles and prizes and things to be won. You have a good meal, meet a lot of people who are interested in the outdoors and conservation, and the money you spend on the dinner tickets and whatever else you do to entertain yourself goes toward a good source of conservation funding and help. So,
well, Scott, we're going to have to leave it there, but that's a great suggestion. Scott, as always, thanks for spending time with us to talk about Wisconsin wildlife. He'll be back on March 6th. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.